This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. Get the true crime that's worth your time delivered to your inbox in newsletter form every weekday at bestevidence.fyi. And don't forget, if we have 2,000 paid subscribers by August of 2020, we will cover the Theranos trial in person. And now, on with our episode.
So what'd he kill? 7, 8 nurses?
9.
Why'd he do it? What'd he say?
Lunch, everybody!
Trust me, you don't want to know.
Sure we do.
This week, it's two legendary directors, no waiting. Netflix's Mindhunter returns for a second season and a new lineup, as it were, of Notorious Cases, presented by David Fincher. And my guest and I return to 2009 for Steven Soderbergh's hilarious escalating con biopic, The Informant. Welcome to an unintentional longitudinal study of how hard it is to stump the FBI in The Blotter Presents, episode 109. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that talks about how true crime is told and sold. I'm a longtime fan of our first-time guest this week, Will Leach. Hello, Will.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm a longtime fan of yours as well. We've been on Extra Hot Great a few times together. I'm a big fan of this podcast, and I'm a big fan of both of the things we're talking about today. So this is very exciting. It is an honor. I will do my best not to disappoint the longtime Blotter listeners.
Well, we have what has been a rarity lately, two properties that are both pretty good and lived up to expectations. So let's get into the more recent one first. In our Most Wanted section, we are talking about the second season of Mindhunter, which dropped last Friday in its entirety on Netflix. Here is the case file from the show's Wikipedia page, since it's covering a number of actual cases whose case files would be like 17 paragraphs each, even boiled down. I'm just going to go with a big font headline overview. Quote, catching a criminal often requires the authorities to get inside the villain's mind to figure out how he thinks. That's the job of FBI agents Holden Ford and Bill Tench. They attempt to understand and catch serial killers by studying their damaged psyches. Along the way, the agents pioneer the development of modern serial killer profiling. End quote. Ford and Tench are, of course, loosely based on the godfathers of criminal profiling, John Douglas and Robert Ressler, respectively, I think, and on Douglas's first book, also called Mindhunter. In the second season, the action has moved on from the first, more primitive attempts to create and explain profiling. And as the Reagan presidency begins, our heroes are struggling to integrate their behavioral science work with more traditional detective/police work and with their personal lives such as they are. We will get into that part. It had been 2 years since this had been on. I had forgotten all except the most general positive feelings about the show. Will, how did it feel for you to get back into it after a couple of years?
You know, it was funny. I actually went back. I did go back and rewatch it all before it came back last week. It's funny because they kind of Netflix ordinarily likes to give these things out early for season two, and they did that not at all this year. I think they didn't.
Yeah.
I know we didn't get them. I don't think anybody got them this year, which is why I think there have not actually been a ton of reviews of the show, and why I'm only 6 into the 9. I apologize for
right.
Our listeners. It was a busy weekend, but I will say that coming back into the show. I'm a Fincher honk, to be honest. I'm on the Grierson Leach podcast. I do every time we talk about Fincher, I joke that I wish every movie could be made by David Fincher. And I know that would take
really
forever.
Joking. I wouldn't be. Right?
And I think that's the thing, is there's something so meticulous and rigorous about Fincher that even with a movie like Gone Girl, which is the book, it's fine. It's kind of poppy, a little trashy, and he makes it so rigorous is really kind of the word for it. So I feel like he elevates everything he does in a way that you know, he actually doesn't direct all the episodes of this, but even the ones he doesn't, they're all established in kind of his worldview. And so I remember when this first came out, I thought it was strange that Fincher would want to do another serial killer project. And I worried that it would be a little bit too kind of postmodern. It would be a commentary, too much of a commentary about caring about serial killers. And obviously, some of that's in there. But one of the things I kind of like about Mindhunter, and generally speaking, is it both comments on delivering the goods while still delivering the goods, if that makes sense.
And
I like that, like, you are supposed to think about, why do I care about these stories? Why do I care about these people? Why am I so invested into the worst parts of human nature? I think it doesn't separate itself from that while also understanding that, like, hey, look, here's Charlie Manson. Here, look, here's Ed Kemper. And I think that it does an excellent job of balancing that in a way that, frankly, I would almost exclusively trust Fincher to do.
I have to say, I had absolutely no worries even before seeing the first season that he was going to be able to handle his shit in this regard, because Zodiac, I think, is really, I mean, it's wonderful. I've watched it like probably 36 times, which I guess is creepy of me, but like, I just admire the build of it so much, because you know, this is what I do and think about is true crime narrative and what makes it good or bad or successful or trashy or not those things, or a combination of those things at times. Keith Morrison, I see you. But he, you know, I tend to come into these projects of his knowing a fair bit about whatever case or killer he's talking about. And he's really able to, like, unpack the case elements, give you a lot of exposition, still tell me things I don't know about the case, and not have it feel like it just feels very natural. It feels like the way that law enforcement talks to each other and talks to civilians. Like, he has just a really good ear for how to make these conversations, like, to give them narrative tension, within the narrative, but also for the viewer who, like, I went into Zodiac just arms folded, like, this is going to be stupid. Fuck this. 2 hours and 40 minutes. Like, they're going to get all this shit wrong. And he got so much of the shit right. And then he has this, like, very dark humor. Like, he just finds the humor in the edges of it. And just Robert Downey Jr. is glorious in that movie. And just looking at that bright blue drink of Gyllenhaal's, yes, it just, like, won me over immediately. So that combination, he makes it look very matter of fact, but you know, you're watching this, and before you know it, it's like 40 minutes have gone by, and you really don't even notice. So that's really something, that Fincher is really good at the processy parts of a procedural, that he's like, here is how it proceeds, and he shoots it in an interesting way, and the production design, of course, is fucking amazing. Yes, it's a little overboard with the sepia tones in this one, but yeah, it's really something. I pulled a clip where this guy, this, like, I think local cop or possibly like local, like, Kansas City bureau guy is turning over the BTK files to Bill Tench because they're beginning to realize that these are all connected. And he's briefing him on the case file. This is stuff that a lot of viewers will know, but it's really elegantly and economically done. So here's clip two.
Jesus, sorry, a poet is he is a criminal mastermind.
7 kills is pretty successful.
Now look at the first one. So sloppy, it's a miracle he got away with it. The Otero family, 74. 4 people, broad daylight, the father, 2 kids, and the dog were home. There were so many things that were just couldn't have been planned.
Complicated knots. What's that on his head?
Plastic bag and 2 t-shirts. A couple of months later, the police got their first letter. gave details only the real guy could know. That's when they called.
What'd you tell him?
That it was real. Most likely he'd kill again. You know how it was in those days. We were talking about bedwetting.
I mean, look at how much information you're getting about not just this case in a very naturalistic way that doesn't feel like it's for the benefit of... Like if you look at late season CSI, where experienced techs are just, walking and talking to each other about shit that they know. They're like, well, just a reminder that when you use this kind of fingerprint powder, it's like they would not have this conversation with each other.
Right.
They do this job together all fucking day. But this gives you a lot of information about the case. And then it's also telling you something about the people in the case and how this transition was occurring between like law enforcement really not believing that serial killers were a thing to this being kind of not just the default assumption in a lot of cases, but this narrative preoccupation that took over the scripted culture. So well done, obviously.
Yeah, it reminds
me... From Holt McElhaney, of all people, like, we've found his lane. We have found Holt McElhaney's lane, and I hope he never turns off the road, because he is great in this.
He's perfect. Like, he is what the show is, right? Like, there is not a moment that he isn't believable, and he feels lived in and sad and yet invested. There's so many sides to that character. One of my favorite quiet things about him is actually how charming he is in social situations. Like, that's something
and
that...
has to be, because Ford is such a disaster.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think he's just that character is so well thought out. I always think of a scene in season one where he and his wife are fighting, and he's in the wrong, and he knows that she's in the wrong, he's in the wrong, and she knows he's in the wrong. But the way he plays it is so like emotionally vulnerable that not only do you find him sympathetic, she finds him sympathetic, and ultimately you realize that like this is a good guy through all of this. He is I feel like he is the North Star in the show. I know Jonathan Groff has like the more like perhaps showy role, though I think that's actually become less as it's kind of gone along. I think the show kind of inevitably leans more toward Bill, I think, as it's going along, which is, I think it's great. I think one thing I like about the show, I think it speaks to Fincher's sensibilities, right? He's going to have less emotional connection to the super genius that's the savant that just knows everything. He likes the wonks. He likes the guy that goes through the paces and goes through the procedures of everything. And to me, that's what I love about Bill, and I think that's why he's become more and more the center of the show. And never minding all the personal stuff going on in Bill's life, that's what I kind of love about. And you talk about how in CSI, there's so much exposition. I always think about how in 24, like the first 20 minutes of every episode of 24 are a recap of what happened in the last 20 minutes of the previous episode of 24.
Yeah,
and everything is constantly moving the story forward. That speaks to a director and a show that trusts its audience. And I feel like that of all the Fincher things, signatures throughout all of his work, he trusts the audience. He absolutely trusts the audience. He'll telegraph something if he has to, but like early on in his career, he was a little bit more showy, I think, and he was more willing to have the here comes the part where I'm directing. And I feel like as he's gotten older and kind of gotten past the Fight Club, which I think is still good, by the way, but kind of gotten past that I'm the brilliant young visionary guy and gotten more kind of comfortable, it's all about like, you know what, I this is good and I know it's good and I trust the audience to understand that it's good, and it makes it that much more exciting.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you really have a point about like he is he feels fondly towards the savant, but his real sympathies are with the grinder, Paul Avery in Zodiac, or even less Paul Avery, Toski. Mm-hmm. So, and then that's definitely true. That's definitely true here. And I think also that like reading Douglas and Ressler's respective books. Like, Douglas has a really good, you know, he's a self-promoter, like, ruthlessly, which he had to be, and he has an excellent co-author on a lot of these books, and his The Cases That Haunt Us, you know, I love it, but he's really sometimes hard to plug into as a narrator. Like, he's not all that relatable, and Ressler is much more of the tench. So that's always interesting for me to watch with that in the back of my head. And then there's, like, I feel like there's always a character in these Fincher crime joints that is, like, just kind of making his own fun, for lack of a better term. Like, you know, in Zodiac, the coffee cart guy with the little stripy smile who's always yeah. like occasionally has some comment about the TV, like his intonation of they're looking at something on TV and he's like, that is fucked up. I just love that guy. That I don't think it's the same actor, although it could be for all I know, but that sort of guy, that like snarky Greek one-man chorus, is back in clip three to explain that no, Ford did not have a heart attack, and also them head shrinkers, what are they good for?
I didn't have a heart attack.
The panic was protracted. We finally had to sedate you. You'll want to watch for panic disorder and repeat episodes.
It could happen again.
What caused it in the first place?
I treat the body, not the mind. I can send you down the hall to look at ink blots, but my advice is manage your stress and try not to do whatever you were doing the first time it happened. If it recurs, benzodiazepine works. Here's a script with one refill.
Valium?
Good luck. You're my first patient to walk out of here in 25 years.
Yeah, wow. For the record, I hope a doctor never says that to me. or says that as a loved one of mine is coming into the doctor. Like, oh, wow, maybe you've got the chance to be the first patient to walk out in 25 years.
Oh, my God. I mean, for context, listeners, they're in a prison hospital, but...
Right. Still.
I just love that he's like, huh, it like occurs to him that this is true, and it doesn't occur to him not to voice this. To these people who are both like a little freaked out at the circumstances. But that's the thing that I like about Fincher in this genre, is that he takes it seriously. You know, he takes the work seriously, he takes the story seriously, but he understands that there are people in it who you know, that there are these moments of mordant humor. And thank God, otherwise it's like really a lot of time to spend with these people and this subject matter with no levity. So little moments like that are definitely important, and he uses them in just the right amounts. So I think that overall the second season is successful. You have not watched the whole thing, even though I have, but
I'm two-thirds. I'm almost there.
You have watched enough, I think, to speak to my next comment, which is or not even really a comment, because I haven't quite decided how I feel about some of the parallel storylines. First of all, Dr. Wendy is around and is having a fringe reunion with their new boss, Ted Gunn, who I kept calling Tim Gunn in my notes. No, not very different show. But as happy as I was to see her again, it did feel as the season went on like she was being increasingly sidelined. I mean, just through no fault of the stories, that's just how it ended up. But I thought that that was a pity, and I thought that the story, her story that was outside of work, was just an effort to keep Anna Torv in play. And as a result, I wasn't sure it was entirely successful. Based on what you've seen of that, did that feel organic to you? Successful?
Yeah, it felt like, I mean, listen, this is a question you can really ask. You know, I don't know if there's some sort of test for this, but like, if she, I'll put it this way, if she's not a closeted lesbian, I'm not sure what is it is. I think she, I feel like the story has to focus on that so much because it is sidelining her otherwise. And I think that some of that stuff's good. I kind of like, I think there's a little character beats. I think she's very well played. And there's little character beats. I remember back in season one when she got like quietly obsessed with the cat in the laundry room.
Yes.
That I thought were like really kind of interesting little notes that like, I liked when we learn stuff about her personality in drips rather than this season where it feels like, okay, we need to just give her something active to do because this story, she's really not a big part of the story this year. And I feel like even though she may actually get almost more screen time and more more off work life fleshed out in season two, I almost feel like she was a little bit more interesting in season one. And where she is just kind of this mysterious character who seems lonely but okay with it. It's really, really kind of interesting. And so I wish that she were more part of the story. That said, I do feel like I did enjoy that this season we've got to see her do some interviews. That's been very fun to watch. I think she's really good and those are played really well. It's also a good reminder too that usually she does them with Greg. And screw Greg. Yeah. Screw Greg. I hate Greg so much. And so, but I kind of like that. I think the way that she handles that is really good whenever she's, because I mean, I feel like particularly in the first season, the core driving thrusts of the show, even with everything else going on, is when Holden or Bill are doing the interviews. They have this like chemistry together and the way they work off of each other. And you can just, the way that Bill will look at Holden or Holden will look at Bill for a moment really just says so much. And I feel like the first episode of season two really has that with all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting everybody back together, they're figuring out what they're going to do with stupid Greg, who stupid sucks, stupid Greg. When they're figuring out what they're going to do with him, that's kind of interesting. And they're trying to reconstruct and they've got the new boss and that's all really good. And then she just doesn't really get to be a part of that anymore. And I think that's kind of disappointing. But I will say, if it is in service of getting more Bill, which I think we did get a lot more Bill in season two, I'm definitely okay with that. Because I will make that trade if I have to. Because I just think Bill is kind of the intellectual and emotional heart of the series. And he's just played so, so well that there is something – I feel like I understand Wendy a little bit, and I feel like I understand Holden, and I feel like I've known people like that. I know Bill. Like, I know Bill. I've known people like, but there's something about him that feels fully realized that even in season two, Holden feels a little bit less of.
Yeah, it's true. I've said before, vis-a-vis Zodiac, that Fincher has a real gift for, and this was true of, what's it called? Panic Room, too.
Yeah.
Actually, weirdly, that he has a real ear for a lived-in work relationship. And you see it with Anthony Edwards and Ruffalo in Zodiac, and you see it with the thieves in Panic Room, but also with Jodie Foster and Kristen Stewart, weirdly. That there's just this, like, I don't know, that sort of a... It's like a non-romantic relationship that, like, his way of rendering, like, work spouses, but, you know, at times before we had that name for that relationship, is really good at the particular intimacy of working partners that isn't always... It's just not something that you necessarily see done well, but... Holt McElhaney, and particularly, like, I don't know if it's the writing or this performance or a wonderful fit combination of both that's greater than the sum, but in the clip I'm about to play, he's so good at sort of relating to your average, like, local cop who is not used to this level of violence and sadism, and this may have been his first dead body that he saw. He's so good at, like, getting the information that he needs and also showing the audience how the process of the job of profiling was still like a road that they were building while they were driving on it. And he is able to smoke cigarettes and drink beer like an actual fucking person would do, which on TV, I have to tell you, the number of these people just like puffing on a clove or like that's obviously ginger ale. And I get it if it's take 14 and you're like, I can't with the Schweppes, but there's something about an actor who can like just do those things realistically that I just appreciate the courtesy. And here's clip four.
My partner and I had stayed over the first three nights.
In the house.
Hoping the killer would come back.
You see anything?
Nothing. A month later, we stayed the night in there again. With a psychic.
You consulted Uri Geller before the FBI.
We were grasping at anything. That poor guy got so freaked out. He was gone the second the sun came up. So is that true? These guys return to the scene of the crime. We're just going on what we'd always heard, old detective stories. Psychopath feels guilty or something.
Ed Kemper, the co-ed killer.
Yeah.
He told us he went back, but not out of anything like guilt. He considered those places somehow sacred, if you can imagine that. Truthfully, we haven't been asking that question, but we probably should.
Yeah, just that little bit at the end tells you so much about how this series is constructed and how this character is constructed. And I completely agree that this guy is so central to it. So I guess we have to talk about Tench Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Brian. Brian. So I don't think, I mean, there is some...
The last, for the record, just so that's saying, the last I've seen of Tench is when Tench Jr. is when he's watching the girl on the playground.
Okay,
That's the last I've seen with him. So I'm sure more. I'm sure that story comes up again.
It does.
Yes.
Matters continue to devolve. I won't get into specifics, but I do have a clip from its past where you are, but I don't think it really spoils anything.
Yeah.
And I am really torn about how I feel about this decision to make Brian, their 7-year-old, who is adopted, to put him right sort of on the borderline of we need to talk about Brian kind of thing. Like, I'm just not sure. Like, I think that's its own whole other show. And then you also have Tench like literally flying back and forth between Atlanta and Virginia, trying to hold his family together and then hold this investigation together. Because if he leaves Ford alone, he's just going to offend the entire city, basically. So he comes home to find his wife in the backyard. She has now started smoking, which is, you know,
always a bad sign.
Universal right. Movie and TV shorthand for shit is now officially a pear. Never mind pear-shaped. And then there is this musing monologue from her facing away from Bill in clip 5.
I was washing his hair. He was playing with that stupid boat of his. I forgot what he'd done. And for a minute, it was just me and my beautiful boy. I got him out, wrapped him in a towel, started brushing his hair. And I saw us in the mirror, the two of us, bath time. And I was so relieved.
Relieved.
Relieved that he wasn't really mine. His body didn't come from my body. None of it was my fault.
Oof. Yeah, that's not good.
that's just not good.
That's like everything that we've been talking about being like Fincher stands because he doesn't do.
Yeah.
He just did. I mean, I know he didn't write that.
Right,
but it's
right,
like,
right.
Here's the thing. This is a fascinating, like, sort of personal life direction to go with one of your central characters, if not, like, the heart of your show. But there's so much there that I feel like that needs to be, like, a web series or a podcast or, like, a I don't know, like Blair Witch type auxiliary blog. I don't know if it works. And that kind of like, you know, tone poem about their like the continuing issues with him and like, is this child broken? Did he come that way? Did they break him? I don't know. How were you at episode six? How were you feeling about how this integrated into season two?
You know, sometimes it parallels a little bit too much for me, which is to say, I feel like so much of the show has been building up, say, to the Charles Manson interview. And as much as I think that scene is really well played, and we've spoken before about how this, the real life things, the way it parallels the stories and the way, like, I've seen everything about Charles Manson at this point, and I still feel like this actually had something new to give me about Charles Manson, totally. Which I thought was really interesting. And I think speaks to what this show does so well. What I wish I didn't have that so much is to be like, oh, but Bill's thinking about his son right now. Like, I don't know if I need that, or he needs to not be in the room and to be with his son. It's kind of how I feel with a lot of that stuff is, you know, and it feels it's a really big issue for him to have to deal with, to have it be the kind of time-honored entertainment trope of the guy or the woman who is torn between something going on at home and their dedication to their job. Mm-hmm. Like, it's real. Like, those are, like, I understand. I'll put it this way. Bill, what happens to Holden at this end of season one? I don't know if that happens to Bill at the end of season two. I would be surprised because he seems so kind of solid. But I think that's the thing, right? Like, those are two massive things to be really pulling on him. And I felt like a lot of that was done so well in season one when the kid and the babysitter find the pictures.
Yeah.
And there, like, he feels guilty, but he's also devoted to his job, and he knows he's done wrong, but he also knows that this is a calling and something that he thinks is important that he has to do. That feels like a more organic conflict than, oh, well, this guy that has to deal with all these people that may or may not have been screwed up from birth, and is it nature or is it nurture or whatever this is, it's actually happening. The call's coming from inside the house. And it sometimes feels a little on the nose. It's played so well, and it's done so, it's acted so well, and it's written so well. But I do feel like it's an extra, like, again, I don't know, I'm sure in 2034, when we get Mindhunter season three, maybe this will pay off a little bit more, but or in the last few episodes, I suppose. But it does feel, it's just a big, big thing. It, you almost feel like, dude, you need to quit your job. Like, you need to, like, go take care of this situation, or, you know. And I actually think that Stacey Rocha, who plays Nancy Tinch, is, the way that she devolves throughout the season is impressive. Like, I actually think that's really good. And I think does a good job of steering clear from a lot of the suffering wife at home role.
Well, that's the thing, that it's sort of like, I hate the, the sort of trope where the wife or the, you know, family of the cop is acting like they just realized what it means to have married or been born to a cop 10 minutes before, like, the cameras started rolling.
This is the sissy SpaceX and JFK role where it's like, Jim, what about your family?
Oh,
like,
God. Yeah,
I know. And that's always a sign of lazy writing, or an Oliver Stone movie, who I think every movie he made in the 90s had that role at one point. But
he had it together to be married, and now he doesn't because he's obsessed with XYZ.
He's so obsessed with Marriott. Yeah, right. And there's a little bit of that in Zodiac, but done much better, I think. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of that in Zodiac, but I think done a little better. And I think it's done well. It's just that, like, it's almost as if the show, to make sure that it avoided that cliche, made the thing going off at home be, like, so massive that it pulls at every possible angle. And I that's what I mean. Like, I feel like it's good and it's well done, but maybe I'm being just a jerk here. I'd actually just like to see a good old school Holden and Bill interrogation of Charlie Manson without having to worry about going home.
I mean, and it's like, it's fine to sort of want to give the audience, I guess, a rest, or like to, you know, mix it up a bit so that you're not constantly sort of like either tense or you're always in an interrogation. Like, you want some terrain, you want some like momentum terrain in the narrative, and that's fine. But it's not like a story about, like your 7-year-old possibly being Dahmer is all that restful for the audience. Like, it just keys it up to an even higher pitch. And there's this one scene, you know, that where they come upon the crime scene that Brian was involved in, and the, you know, the powder that is around the cross shape. And it's just, I mean, there is some harrowing material in this season, because of course there is, because it's Mindhunter. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure if it worked. And I think it's a testament to Fincher and the actors that it came close. I almost didn't. I almost was sort of like, oh yeah, well, let's talk about this as a successful element. I still haven't quite made up my mind. How did you feel about the various sort of like big like headline cases that we all knew were coming? Berkowitz, Manson, and of course Wayne Williams. Did you feel that was all that stuff was pretty well done?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it's so kind of well integrated that I found myself going back and going, oh wait, so it actually does have all the details right. Like, some of the times, some like the way the stories are told and the way the interviews are going, the way they kind of fit in to where a lot of the interviewers that we've seen on some of the lesser known, though also still factual, serial killers we've seen earlier, it's impressive. I find myself going back to the Wikipedia page after the show and be like, oh yeah, that is actually what happened. And then, like, the way that's integrated is really well. I will say, we touched this when we talked about Charlie Manson, I found it impressive that the Manson scene in particular. I feel like the Son of Sam one is a little bit less interesting. I actually find Son of Sam a little bit less interesting than some of these other serial killers in Will Leach's serial killer power rankings. Sorry, Son of Sam, you're a little lower down there. But to me, the Manson thing, and I think the Ed Kemper thing, but particularly the Manson thing, the idea that you see the magnetism of his personality, and you see kind of his worldview, and you see how manipulative he can be and how charismatic he can be, while still also being like, oh, you're also fucking crazy. Like, and still like making that character feel real is really impressive. Like, that's a really hard thing to do. Like,
introduce some doubt there also.
Yeah, totally.
For
totally.
Them to be like, oh, well, you know, this narrative really is how, this isn't Charlie's narrative, this is how Vincent Bugliosi had to package it to get an indictment of this, you know, sawed off psycho. So that's what he did. And, you know, I'm actually not sure what I think is true. And I suspect that if Bugliosi were still around, he'd be like, well, what would you have done to get Manson off the street again? Like, fair. That's legit. He wasn't one to apologize for himself, that one.
Right. It was fun seeing Tex after seeing Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and seeing Tex played this way as he is in this show, which I think is really good, right? Like, I feel like there's again, like everything else with this show, it's well thought through. It's well thought through. It's well constructed. As much as there is a headline of, oh, here comes Charlie Manson, oh, here comes Son of Sam, here comes Wayne Williams, it's still, I keep going back to this word, it's still rigorous. Like, it's still well thought and well put together. And it's not just like, here's the killer of the week, here he comes.
It doesn't feel like, I feel confident that they looked at a number of people that these real guys really talked to in the actual timeline of like the turn of the 80s, and that, I mean, if I'm directing this, I'm going to try to avoid Manson if at all possible, because we've all had enough of that guy. Enough. Like, Discovery Channel alone has had like 15 specials in the last month, because it's August of 2019, and that's what happens. I get it. I work in this sector. But you have to imagine that everybody in the production was like, unless this really adds something, we can't put it in, because otherwise it's just cheap. And I think that the people that they went back to and used that are the, you know, big headlines. First of all, they're alongside other lesser known cases that were also interesting. And I think that it was narratively necessary to have Berkowitz in there, to have Manson in there, that they proved that out, and that, you know, by talking to Tex, they sort of, you know, they had the research bona fides, I felt. And I will say, one of my tests for things like this is like, is it holding my attention enough that I'm not looking at the Wikipedia entry? And I have to say, right. Mindhunter season right. 2, it was like, I made a couple of notes to check things later, but I was just in it the whole time. Like, are there things that I'm not sure they should have done? Are there lines of dialogue that didn't work? Yes and yes. Am I positive that the show knows what it thinks about what happened with the Atlanta child killings? No. Like, I'm not sure that the ambivalence that the audience is given, or the ambiguity that the audience is given, is purposeful. I think maybe the show isn't totally sure what happened. But it's just really compelling. It's really well done. And it was a, you know, pleasure, maybe. It's not a great word for this kind of thing, but it was really nice to be back with these people and in this story again. And I'm looking forward to 2034 and having this beamed into my earport at the old age home on Mars. Are you going to finish out the season when you get a chance?
Oh, I'm literally, as soon as I get off this call.
Okay.
if we'd have moved this back 3 hours, I would have had all night.
Yes, once again, Mindhunter season 2, both seasons are on Netflix, and I think we both recommend it.
Very much so.
All right, so let's get you back to that as soon as possible and zip through our cold case. I can't believe this movie is already 10 years old.
Right?
We're talking about The Informant! Exclamation mark. Here is the case file, which, here again, this could be seriously me reading for 2.5 hours. I'm just going to go with the IMDb's The Massey Twins. I roll emoji, and their summary of the film. Quote, Mark Whitaker has worked for lysine developing company ADM for many years and has even found his way into upper management. But nothing has prepared him for the job he is about to undertake, being a spy for the FBI. Unwillingly pressured into working as an informant against the illegal price-fixing activities of his company... Sick. Whitaker gradually adopts the idea that he's a true secret agent, but as his incessant lies keep piling up, his world begins crashing down around him, end quote. I'm not sure how unwillingly Whitaker participated in anything, but I can tell you that Matt Damon, as Whitaker, is more than willing to don an unflattering toupee and bungle his way through the informant's Byzantine fraud plotting while voicing over factoids about Japanese fetish vending and much more.
How is that okay? How is that okay?
That's my favorite line. I just love these little facts. Like, this is someone who... like, the writing is so good at communicating the preoccupation of this person at that he wants to have outsmarted everyone, and yet the way he outsmarts himself is with this overweening need to let everyone know that they've been outsmarted, that trips him up every time. That and the wig. You suggested that we watch this one. Do you just like it? Is it an Illinois thing? Why'd you suggest this one?
It is definitely both. It's worth noting, not only I am from Central, I'm from Illinois. I'm not only from Illinois, I'm from Central Illinois. In fact, I am from Mattoon, Illinois, but more to the point, my mother, my beloved mother, is from Moquegua, Illinois, which is where not only where Mark Whitaker lived, they actually used Mark Whitaker's real mansion. And by a mansion, by the way, in Moquegua, Illinois. Moquegua is a very rural town that has literally one stop sign and one gas station, has 1,500 people. It is 45 minutes from Decatur, Illinois, which is where Archer Daniel Midland was in the mid-90s when all this happened.
Unfortunately, Moquegua, not staying. Oh, yeah.
yes. And so Moquegua is, like, I spent every Christmas in the town of Moquegua for 15 years. So I, like, to see Moquegua, Illinois again, stirred me. We all knew the story. This was going on when I was in college at the University of Illinois. It was the biggest scandal. My late grandmother, who lived in Moquegua her entire life, updated me every day about it. She knew the Whitakers. She was very excited about all of this. It was amazing. Like, it was when this story. I read the book years ago. I read the book before I saw the movie the first time, and have not read it since. Though I have since got out my old copy after watching it again, because this is my, like, this is my neck of the woods. This is where I'm from. I can't put it any other better way. This is amazing. Steven Soderbergh, of all the different things he does in the movie, it's strange to me with, you know, he's got this crazy Marvin Hamlisch score, and it's like half ironic, and everything is all kind of caked in with all the comedians playing the small roles, which is funny because I did not know Andy Daly in 2009. So, like, watching him now, I'm like, hey, it's Andy Daly. So for me, it's fun to for all the things it gets right, it really gets Central Illinois so right, which is to say there is, and the Midwest in general, but specifically this small town area. I know how Mark Whitaker feels to feel like the best, biggest thing you could possibly be would be like the head of this small, of this little branch of this sad chemical company, and a good spot at the table at the Decatur Country Club. Like, I know it. Like, I feel that in my bones. So, like, to watch this, and I remember when all this happened. I remember the whole story of it. I mean, the Whitakers were, I mean, I had heard of the Whitaker family before all this happened. Because I mean this was happening, but before the word came out that it happened, because they were the really, really wealthy people in Moquegua, Illinois, because most people lived in Decatur or they would come down from Chicago. It was a choice for him to live in Moquegua, which is just right. No people don't commute. It was a place for him to be there. So the fact that they filmed it, a good friend of mine is an entertainment reporter for the Decatur Herald and Review. He actually gets a line in the movie. It made me so, just the amount of, like, good warmth. But to watch it again, I have to tell you, I love this movie, independent of the fact that it sums up most of my childhood. It is so, so good. And so much of it comes down to Damon. Damon, I think, particularly as he's gotten older, there's a certain self-satisfaction that I think sometimes kind of sneaks into his performances a little bit, but it's not here.
It's leveraged into, right. It's sort of like steered into the character. Let me play clip six, which really goes to the utter lack of vanity in this performance. Like, think about when you hear the line involving the name Bri, think about all the line readings that you might be tempted to give that, and then think about the one that he picks. Here's clip six.
He seems like a real good guy. I hope he doesn't mind me calling him Brian instead of Agent Shepard. I might even try Bri out. This must be very different for him, talking to a guy like me instead of a bank robber or a drug dealer. I could see us fishing or whatever. What a good listener. You don't meet one of those every day.
I mean, this, like, this person is, and I have no doubt that this is, this sort of, like, running monologue to self is taken from life. Like, I just, it just feels very authentically narcissistic, and this performance is really amazing. Not to mention the literally dozens of "Hey, it's that guys" who are obliged to stare literally open-mouthed at either at Whitaker or at whatever, Byron Hadley from Shawshank, being like, check this shit out. And Cusack, the camera's on her for like 45 seconds in a row. And she's like, like a fly is just going in. Oh my God, it's so good. And here's the really brilliant part about it. This is a really difficult, like, cons and frauds are like really fascinating. Obviously, we as a society are super into them. And I think it's kind of amazing that Marvin Hamlisch does the soundtrack, because he, of course, did The Sting. And that's what Whitaker thinks he's in. Yeah. Like, that's what he thinks his life is. But he... cons and frauds are actually harder than they sometimes can seem to illustrate in a visual way without relying on a lot of like chyrons or like animations or things that it's like, why wasn't this just a New Yorker article versus like a documentary or a biopic? So Soderbergh is not only doing that, but this script is like keeping the audience in the same, at the same level of information as law enforcement, and kind of letting, like letting Whitaker's reveals be revealed by Whitaker and not cheating the timeline at all. And that's actually really hard to do, especially since there, like, I still think the movie is not coming down on either side of, how much of the truth he actually ended up telling. I would tend to say not.
Oh my God. I've forgotten how perfect the ending of this movie is when he talks to Joel McHale and says,
oh my God,
that's why I stole the $11 million. It's like, wait, what did you say? $11 million? It's like, oh, who can remember? Is like, what a perfect way for this
and
movie.
And he just like that the calcium is just draining out of McHale's backbone. I mean, you will see this in the visual aids. That's Blutter Presents on Facebook and Twitter. I had a number of screenshots, including one of Tony Hale just being like, what? Oh, oh my God.
Where they get the elevator? Oh, where they get, my favorite is when they get the elevator. It's like,
so good. Speaking of the soundtrack, I cut this clip, which is when... Mark is really getting into his spy feels in clip 7, mostly for the Ocean's 11 meets Secret Agent Man soundtrack cue. Here's clip 7.
Excuse me, I need a comfort break. Hard day. Side 2, tape 1. Side 2, tape 1.
The nose plays. The nose plays. Yeah, it's just so... it's so good. And then, I mean, Melanie Lins... National Treasure, Melanie Linsky. Right. Just like, what? She's just... oh my God, she's great. This movie is really a lot of fun. And, you know, here again... like the storytelling is so like, it takes itself seriously, but it doesn't, it takes the story seriously, but not itself. So it's making what it's doing look a little easier than it actually is. And it just flies right by. And this is another one where I was like, so did that actually happen? Or did he actually start embezzling because he had the immunity? I should look that up. But I wasn't like off on my phone doing it while I was watching. Did you have that absorbing experience with it still?
Yeah, particularly watching it this time. Because, I mean, listen, the first I saw this, like, opening day, the first day, I couldn't wait to watch this movie. And if just because, again, so much, I have my personal connection to it. But, like, watching it over the years and watching it again this time, I find myself even more impressed of kind of what Soderbergh's able to pull off, particularly when it comes to that narrative, because I have to tell you, this is a movie where the incredulity, I can't say that word correctly, is the dominant response, that you're having the same reaction that everyone is having. Just the, like, to me, there's just so many, like, Scott Bakula and Joel McHale baffled, like, when they're at the Chinese restaurant, and you just see them slow, like, their spines just slowly, like, melt.
McHale looks like he's about to get his community rage on, and Bakula just looks completely defeated and nauseous. Oh god, it's so good.
And the note on that too at the end, where like literally Brian is like still so, because I mean he's the one spends the bulk of the movie trying to protect him and trying to make sure that Mark is okay, and the fact that he won't even see him at the end, there's something about. But I will say, what surprised me the most too, Soderbergh, you know, is a filmmaker that loves to he likes to challenge himself. He likes to zig when he should be zagging. There's something even sometimes self-defeating about Soderbergh. But I think the narrative challenge he kind of puts on himself and pays off in a pretty incredible way is that voiceover narration and the idea of the unreliable narrator. Where obviously it's a little different this time because he's often just yammering on about again vending machines in Japan. But they speak to that kind of myopia. And what increasingly becomes clear is a disorder, is bipolar disorder. And the way where it comes to when he is talking with his wife and Scott Bakula at the end, and all of a sudden this narration that we've had all the way through, it finally all breaks down on it. Finally all breaks down. And we get the first real, genuine moment of emotion from that narration where he just says, I don't know. And there's something, and it can only last for a second, and then he's back to his bullshit again. But there is something about that I was surprised how emotional it got me watching it this time. There's something very affecting about this character who I've spent most of the movie being like, dude, like, come on. Like, I can't believe, and I frustration and exasperation. There is something there, I think, that speaks to how good Damon is in this. I did not realize I actually still, in spite of it, kind of cared about him. A little bit until that moment.
Well, and there's a, you know, it's hard to separate. When you get to the end, you wonder how much of this, corn-fed, guileless-seeming, you know, aw shucks part of the voiceover and part of this character, can you separate that from the con? Is the question, and I'm not sure he can, but I think that we can. I think that some parts of him are genuine, but we can't look to him to identify which parts those are. But you're also like, this guy's a jackass, as someone says in so many words. I think Byron Hadley calls him a horse's ass, and he is, and he's what Edith Wharton would have called a striver. He's that too. There are repellent aspects to him, but that Matt Damon makes this character sympathetic in a narrative that is about price fixing in fucking agribusiness. Like, your level of your slope rating on this course is fucking crazy. This is like 18 amen corners in a row. I don't know why I picked a fucking golf metaphor, and I'm leaving it now to the relief of everyone. But this is a really great, I mean, it's a great movie, it's a great story, and as part of like subset of true crime that's about cons and frauds, I think it's a what's the opposite of cautionary tale, instructive as to how to give.
It's aspirational, like,
yes, aspirational, there you go, it's an aspirational tale, literally and figuratively, about how to like the different ways that you can talk about and illustrate and teach, I guess, cons, because, you know, it's hard to do. It's hard to do without like a lot of PowerPointy seeming chyrons, and that, you know, this is a different way to do it that you don't usually see, and it's really successful. And I would just watch this like again now just to look at it and see how it's built, because it's fun to just receive it as narrative, but then you know, as a critic, it's like, well, now I want to look at it again because it's that good. So thank you for bringing this bringing us back to this. This was a good one. Would you recommend the book, or this is over the book?
I would recommend this over the book. Is great, and the book is very, it's very entertaining and very well written and very instructive, and I would highly recommend it. The movie is its own animal. Like the movie feels like more of a magic trick, right? Like we've seen, the book is a straightforward, well done, well researched potboiler of the story of this guy's con and how it falls apart. It is very, very well done and very, and just a pleasure to read. This is a magic trick. Like I really do believe, like The Informant, the movie itself. It is, I mean, I can't believe like a major studio released this. Like, it really, it feels, it made 10 years feel really, really long ago, because it's hard to, this would be at best a movie that like someone snuck over on Netflix, right? Or
that's
or
what
maybe
I was just going to say. Like
or maybe
A24.
Yeah, or maybe A24 because they want to deal with Soderbergh or something. But like on the whole, it doesn't feel, like it feels magical that this movie exists.
Yeah. And I don't think it got nominated for anything. It didn't.
It was not a financial success. Critics liked it, but it's so weird. Like, it's so different. Like, this is a movie that now I feel like it's easier to reflect back on now and kind of appreciate the achievement of it. Where at the time, it's just like so unusual. And there's an exclamation point in the title. Is this a comedy? What's with all these comedy? Like, it's confusing. Like, when you're on the beat, right? And you're constantly like, like this was released the same movie, the same week as Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, you know, like these are the context of this movie kind of coming in and people reviewing it. It's interesting. It's Soderbergh was on like an incredible role kind of at this point. So for him to do this weird little project with Matt Damon as and a story that like I think business people and Midwesterners certainly knew, but a lot of people didn't. It's several bank shots at once, which is a very Soderberghian thing to do. So I think it got lost a little bit. I think this is definitely one of those movies that's grown in esteem as the years have gone along.
Well, and you have like just sort of regular people, character actors in it. Like you're not, nobody's like looking foxy and shirtless on the poster. So
to say the least.
Yeah. I mean, plus it's set in the 90s, enough said. Yes. that'll deflate things.
It's set in 1990s, my Central Illinois. That's what, this is what I live there. So now everyone is shirtless in this area of the country, but not in the way that you're referring to. Entirely. It's been a tough economic 20 years.
Oh, yes. Alas. I was going to make a Stevie reference, but we don't have time to get into that. So maybe next time. Hopefully there will be a next time. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been a delight.
I'm very honored to do it. And I'm sorry I did not finish Mindhunter, but I'm more sorry for me because I really love the show and I wanted to get it there. So I'll be doing that next. And next time, I promise, no matter what, even if I have to hide from my wife and family for years at a time, I will use this podcast as an excuse for doing that.
Or we could just pick something manageably short that respects your other commitments.
Fine.
Okay. What else are you hiding from your wife and family to work on? Please tell listeners where else they can find you. I think you have another season of a show coming up. Is that true?
I do. I host a show on Sports Illustrated. You find it on SI.TV and on Amazon Prime. Just type in The Will Leach Show. I'm doing season three. We're about to start season three of our show. It is a pseudo talk show, pseudo comedy show, pseudo interview show. I don't really know what it is, but they let me keep making it for some reason. I'll be doing that. I write weekly for New York Magazine. I have a tiny letter that I write, a way too complicated, way too time-consuming essay every single week with the links to everything that I write for. If you're a baseball person, I write three times a week for MLB.com. And I just finished a book that hopefully will be sold by the end of September. If not, I hope you'll have me on this podcast again so we can talk about my sadness.
No. Oh. Well, hopefully I think Patreon tipsters will be hearing a little more about that book in the after show. But first, let's wrap up the main podcast. Coming up, we've got John Ramos on scandals in the bridge community and white collar crime. Then I'll be celebrating Labor Day by not laboring. And happy school year to you in jail, because once we get back, it's Happy Jail and Ghosts of Attica, guest TBD. Until then, if you've got a tip for the Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter, and at Eve Beatty's and my True Crime Review newsletter, Best Evidence, as I mentioned, bestevidence.fyi. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so others can find us. If you don't like the podcast, please don't tell anyone. My guest has been Will Leach, and he's on Twitter at William F. Leach. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.